referring to the Torah, which God Almighty had revealed to Prophet Moses as a guide and means of mercy for the Israelites, points to the passages predicting the revelation of the Noble Quran to the last and greatest of messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It means to say that although the language of the Noble Quran is the most flawless and eloquent Arabic, it confirms the veracity of the original Torah, which was in Hebrew. In order to serve as a warning to the wrongdoers, whatever their ethnicity, while giving tidings of salvation and paradise to the true believers. In other words, the contents of all heavenly scriptures are the same, despite the different ages, places, and languages of their revelation. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, since the one and only creator of the universe is the source of revelation of all heavenly scriptures, their contents confirm each other. Number two, all heavenly scriptures, whether the Torah or the Noble Quran, are guidance for human societies and clear indicators of God's mercy. Hence, they invite people to monotheism and virtue by giving them tidings of paradise, while warning the atheist, the polytheist, and all oppressors, including unrepentant sinners, of the punishment awaiting them because of their evil ways. And number three, faith in God is not compatible with wronging others, since it is only true belief that leads to good deeds. Now let us listen to ayahs 13 and 14 of Surah Ahqaf.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ قَالُوا رَبُّنَا اللَّهُ ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا فَلَا خَوْفٌ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا هُمْ يَحْزَنُونَ أُولَئِكَ أَصْحَابُ الْجَنَّةِ خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا جَزَاءً بِمَا كَانُوا يَعْمَلُونَ
Indeed, those who say, "Our Lord is Allah," and then remain steadfast, they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. They shall be the inhabitants of paradise, remaining in it forever, a reward for what they used to do. These ayahs depict the image of true believers who stand firm on the right path, without grief or fear of anything, and content with whatever God has decreed for them, as is evident by their virtuous deeds and words, expressed every often from the depth of their heart. Our Lord is Allah. In other words, true belief is not mere lip service, but is manifested practically by the virtuous life that the believers lead. As the next ayah says, God will reward of true believers both in the transient life of this mortal world and on the resurrection day, when they will be granted the eternal bliss of paradise. There they will remain forever for their good deeds. Paradise is the reward of those who act rather than those who merely talk. The perfect believer is one who never complains of any hurdles in his or her way towards attaining the station of Ainul Yaqeen, or certitude by sight, followed by the still higher degree, faith, that is, haqqul yaqeen, or the ultimate certitude. In short, perfect faith is based on honesty, sincerity, piety, patience, clemency, courage, forbearance, and standing firm on the straight and unwavering path of God by warding off all evils, to the extent that the angels laud such a believer and give tidings of having attained the station of Nafsul Mutma'inna, or the tranquil soul. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, mere verbal expression of faith is not enough, and should be coupled with virtuous deeds and practical steadfastness. Number two, a person who believes in God will not fear anyone or anything. Number three, grieving about the past is for those who have covered the wrong path. So those who are on the right path will not be sad or regretful of the past. And number four, perfect belief grants peace and tranquility to the soul, in contrast to the lack of inward calm and anxiety engulfing the disbelievers, even the rich ones, who, in a bid to reduce stress, take different medicines, but without any avail.
Today. Iran's modernization began in the early 20th century, and by 1979, when the Islamic Revolution took place, the country was comfortable with all modcons and up to its teeth with military equipment. But it was petrodollars buying all that comfort and security with no backup. That is to say, the country lacked enough know-how or heavy machinery to manufacture all that equipment once it was exhausted, if relations with the West soured. Iran felt powerless. To gain independence from powers to the East and West, it erupted in revolution. The leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, returned from exile in France to take the reins of the country. January the 31st this year marked the anniversary of his return. Iran is naturally a land of abundance, but this ancient civilization had its day in antiquity. Modernity is of the West. Iran has tried to catch up, however, and has taken long strides over past decades. But how far has the country gone in international terms, by international standards? How hindering have hurdles been, and what challenges does it face today? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Political, economic, and intellectual independence would not be possible without the expansion of knowledge and science, the Imam reckoned. So he continued the path of modernization with what would appear to be the boldness to attempt sudden nativization of technology. Rather, it was a sudden attempt, but discovery and invention, even reverse engineering, take their own time. But in time, in a matter of decades since the revolution, the country ranks 16th or 17th globally in terms of production of science. Iran is actually making 97% of the medicine it needs domestically. And all this is despite U.S. sanctions imposed against this country. Dr. Shahverdi is the Royan Stem Cell Research Facility Chief. He explains how even Royan is working on a cure for the country's most immediate health challenge, COVID-19. We got to meet him at the Royan Center, where people line up in hope of conception.
On the issue of the coronavirus, because of limitations, the Royan Institute took a valuable step to produce animal models in the lab so that they can work as receptors instead of human models and be used as specimens in several medicinal or vaccine-related studies. Thank God this project is in its final stages. We hope that it can help research teams accelerate their studies so the resulting products can hit the market sooner.
Iran has made giant strides in medicine, nanotechnology, nuclear energy, defense and the production of missiles, aerospace technology, and in heavy industries. Iran ranks fourth in the world in terms of production of nanoscience technology, and seventh and ninth in terms of biotechnology and aerospace industry, respectively. The Basij, or Popular Mobilization Forces, have branched into all sectors. Here at their scientific headquarters, I'll bring you to a commander to see what the Basij might have done in aid of the country's scientific progress or community. Dr. Rahimi is the Science and Research Basij Organization Chief. His specialty is aerospace, so he can later also get into a little detail with how Iran is doing in that field and whether the tenets of the revolution helped advancement. I refer to the tenet of self-esteem and realization of the importance of national identity, without which the self-confidence for scientific progress and therefore independence will come to naught.
In realizing a scientific Basij, we're taking two paths in parallel. One is promoting science inside Basij itself, which has enabled us to develop scientific and technological infrastructure in the country. It has resulted in creation of some 100 growth, development and creativity centers across different provinces. 32 student research centers have been set up and are active in the country. 30 centers for support and guidance of applied and subject-oriented research have been established to assess different issues and needs of the country.
I also got to talk to another couple of people at the Basij headquarters, where there was a science exhibition in the run-up to the anniversary of the revolution. The anniversary is the 22nd of Bahman, or 11th of February, 10th of February this year. Mr. Kazemi is with the Basij organization.
We have more than 300 people in this exhibition that Basij organization have supported them. And they come from different provinces, for example, in 32 provinces in Iran. We have gathered in this exhibition in order to show their product to link it to a place or destination they need.
I got to talk a few words with Mr. Afshar over his stall.
I specialized in X-ray imaging systems, devices that are used for inspection in sensitive buildings, customs, and airports. We produce different types of such imaging devices, including for inspecting large trucks, luggages, and cars. These devices have foreign counterparts and are nothing new, but we have localized over 70% of this technology.
Iran has been isolated by Western powers and therefore abandoned by their weaker allies since the revolution. Economic and military sanctions have even bordered onto siege and genocide, given imports of essential items have also been hindered by US-imposed banking sanctions and secondary sanctions. So it's only natural for Iran to take sole credit for whatever it's achieved since 1979 and the war that followed shortly after. That's the eight-year imposed war with Iraq.
One of the goals of these events and exhibitions that are being held is to create self-confidence and to show our capabilities, especially among the youth of the country, who sometimes make appearances at their own expense, to showcase different technologies and gain knowledge. If we want to bridge the gap between our scientific power and that of the world in a 30-40-year outlook, we must work on a groundbreaking science in a fast and accelerated manner.
Talking of achievement, here's someone who can give us detail on what the nanotech sector has been doing. That would be Dr. Sarkar of the Nanotechnology Special Headquarters. At the headquarters, he assured me Iran makes and even exports the heavy machinery needed to manufacture nanotech goods. He showed me some products, such as nano concrete bricks, which are lighter but firmer than regular bricks due to their minute, well-melded building blocks. He also demonstrated anti-cancer jabs that are more effective with fewer side effects than non-nano jabs.
Starting at the earlier stage, we actually invested on human resources development, scientific activities, technology development,
and the fusion of nanotechnology in our current industry and producing these products and introducing this product to the market. So right now, I can mention that Iran has not only on scientific activities, but also in production and commercialization in the field of nanotechnology is very successful. I can mention that right now we have more than 300 knowledge-based companies in the field of nanotechnology, which they are engaged in producing nano-based products.
By 2017, Iran had jumped to 16th rank globally in nanoscience. As for the number of articles this country published on nano, Iran stands fourth, with Germany, the UK, and Japan coming after. While we are at scientific rankings and achievements, let's allow Dr. Shahverdi the time to tell us of where stem cells are leading the country.
The Royan Institute has started working in several areas related to curing chronic conditions. The use of stem cells is in the clinical trial test phase around the world. The Royan Institute is using stem cells to treat conditions related to cornea, such as burns or other issues, namely transplantation from corpses or brain-dead patients. We are using stem cells to treat bone, cartilage, and joint diseases. In the case of neurological diseases, we are starting the first phase of trials on Alzheimer's and also are working in the third phase of trials on cerebral palsy in CP children.
Look up at the stars and you'll catch a moon. Iran agrees. A favorite challenge with decision makers here is to send satellites into orbit. And the new Zuljanah rocket is to do exactly that, to put a satellite into orbit after completing test launches. Iran is pleased to have completed the test launch of the satellite-carrying rocket below orbit. The satellite carrier, which uses solid fuel in its first two stages of launch and liquid fuel in the third, can carry a satellite weighing up to 220 kilograms for 500 kilometers. Iran also successfully launched the country's first military reconnaissance satellite called Nur in April 2020, after two failed launches and a launch pad rocket explosion. Dr. Ommi is the Aerospace Research Center chief. He joined Press TV by Skype to answer questions on achievements in his field as well as challenges faced by the scientific community at large.
Exiting the atmosphere is a difficult task and needs an extremely powerful propelling force. It requires technology which not all countries have access to. Thank God this has been done in Iran. Probes are starting to become operational. We are going to launch our ninth probe from the Aerospace Research Center. After a few prototypes, these probes started to send live animals out of the Earth atmosphere to altitude about 120 to 130 kilometers.
About time to give Dr. Rahimi the floor to tell us of aerospace achievements. In 2017, Iran ranked 11th in the world in scientific production in aerospace and ranked first in the region in aerospace scientific output.
In order for us to build a flying device, we would need to go through different phases, including design, test, initial flight, and finally mass production. They imposed targeted sanctions on the high-speed test phase. So, if we wanted to design military devices, we had to perform a variety of other test flights that were not economically feasible or even justifiable. So we established a technological task force that assessed the problems and needs. The task force imported all the test equipment needed. Now, one of the same task forces has become the center that has enabled us to easily manufacture and export test devices to measure speeds between 1/10 of a meter to 10 Mach inside the country.
Plenty more to say, but time to give other media outlets a chance too before returning to our narrative. So do stay with me for the news segment. to get to all three outlets, beginning with Tasnim News. Enemy targeting Iran's scientific progress, the IRGC chief warns. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Major General Hossein Salami stressed the need for enhancement of Iran's scientific capabilities, which he said have become a target of hostile actions. While political, economic, or cultural power is usually considered a factor behind the independence of nations, the real source of power is scientific independence, the IRGC commander said. Society will grow if a country's scientific resources are developed. Today, the enemies have waged a war against us in all spheres, including medicine, food, water, and medical care, the commander warned, adding that determination and efforts would turn the hostile threats into opportunities for progress and development. Tehran Times reads, Iran ranks 14th for top universities worldwide. Iran ranked 14th among 102 countries for the highest number of top universities, as 46 Iranian universities were listed on ISC World University Rankings of 2020. ISC is the third internationally accredited citation center established in the Islamic Republic of Iran, based on a resolution adopted in 2008 by the fourth meeting of the Islamic Ministers of Higher Education in Baku, the capital of the Republic of Azerbaijan, to index, evaluate, and publish scientific productions in Islamic countries. There are 2,182 universities from 102 countries in the ranking, of which 46 universities are from Iran, ISNA reported. In 2019, Iran participated with 43 universities, which shows an increased share in the recent ranking. We've got IFP News, which says peaceful nuclear work aimed at boosting national welfare. That's regarding Iran, obviously. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, says the achievements secured in the country's nuclear industry are geared to the welfare of Iranians across the nation. Ali Akbar Salehi said peaceful atomic works are in line with the objectives of the human community, moving on the path to achieving peaceful nuclear technology and enjoying the accomplishments, advantages, and benefits of the nuclear industry are aimed at achieving human goals and creating welfare and comfort at the national level. He said among the blessings of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran and the establishment of its republic have been to reach self-sufficiency, boost domestic capabilities, and pushing back the frontiers of science and technology. And that will be it for the news segment, but the show's still on, so do stay with me. Iran benefits from 3.5 million students. It's no wonder the country managed to promote its rank from 54th in 2005 to 16th in 2019. A point that raises curiosity is the matter of women. Interestingly, while in the year 1979, less than 50,000 university students were girls, in 2009, this figure increased by tenfold to 500,000, and the current figure is about 2 million. Today, about 56% of university students are girls. Some say 70%, depending on the field of study. Iran's adult literacy rate stood at over 84.5% in 2013, going by UNESCO figures, compared to 85% worldwide and 78% in neighboring Arab states. Notably, the literacy rate among 15 to 24-year-olds in Iran is as high as 98%, going by 2015 statistics.
It seems that this revolution has brought about the culmination of serious scientific and technological activities in the country. As far as I know, the number of universities and institutions of higher education in Iran is probably only rivaled by a few other countries in the world. Of course, it is true that some may say that we do not need so many graduates, but in general, when the level of education and knowledge of our nation increases, it will definitely help the growth of our country in all scientific fields.
Prior to the revolution, accredited higher education often ended abroad. But now, with more time, Iran has several accredited universities, from medicine to engineering and the humanities, many of which are attended by foreign students.
We didn't accept that we are developing country. We wanted to be among the advanced countries, and we invested on that. And the most investment in was that you mentioned, it was the self-belief. that we decided, and it was among the top priorities, and actually it was the master plan that Iran should invest on technology development, science generation, and investing on human resources. And that's why before the revolution, in many scientific areas, we had, at the most, we had a BSc degree in the universities. But it was after the revolution that we started to establish MSc programs and PhD program, actually, most of the scientific branches.
Health-wise, the country's life expectancy has risen from 50 to 75 years of age. And the mortality rate of children under 5 dropped to under 15 per 1,000 births. That's down from 5,185 deaths per 1,000 births pre-1979.
Well, the number of doctors has risen drastically. Before the revolution, there were under 6,000 specialists. Now, numbers have increased about sixfold, especially that of female doctors, taking the total of specialists, medical specialists, up to 36,000. This is while Iran's population at the time of the revolution was just over 37 million, and now it's just over 85 million. But to be fair, students were sent to foreign lands well before the revolution, mostly to France, to study medicine in order to return to their homeland and train other students, setting a strong foundation for the future of Iran's medicine, which after the revolution, Iran took to heights.
Based on World Bank reports, in 2009, Iran ranked 21st in terms of the quality and number of hospitals. In 2017, Iran was recognized as the second country globally in controlling contagious diseases. UNICEF thanked Iran for its status of sanitation and medical advances.
توی همون دهه 60 بیماران ما
In the 1980s our patients used to go abroad to get infertility treatment. Our scientists and researchers in the Academic Center for Education, Culture and Research and also the Royal Institute started working on the issue in a timely manner. One of the issues is the matter of stem cells. Early studies on stem cells, namely human embryonic stem cells, were established in 1999. We started working in this field in a few years. One of the medical journals specializing in issues of human reproduction introduced the Royal Institute as one of the top 10 centers active in the field of infertility research and treatment. Today, we have more than 70 infertility centers in the country.
A discipline Iran has made remarkable achievement in is nuclear engineering and science, in spite of efforts at sabotage and assassinations perpetrated by foreign elements, say Israel. By 2017, Iran had published 354 scientific articles in the field, thereby rising to 12th rank globally and first rank regionally in nuclear science.
In my opinion, sanctions can be an opportunity as much as they can be a threat. If we have a powerful ideology, the sanctions will certainly become an opportunity for us. This was realized for diagnostic equipment and other technologies I just told you about. These are technologies that we didn't have access to because of the sanctions.
Iran intends its nuclear program to be peaceful, so I'm putting defense in a separate category. Iran's progress in the construction of defense equipment and missiles is also astounding, given its contemporary history of vulnerability. The country is now capable of manufacturing 90% of its defense equipment inside the country, no less. Iran's arsenal of guided missiles is the largest and most diverse in the Middle East. The country has also developed both cruise and ballistic missiles for use in conventional combat, and it has used such missiles to target Daesh or ISIS.
In order to enter the cycle of science and technology of the country and establish a revolution of modern Islamic civilization, we need to focus our thoughts on that civilization. We need to mobilize all our country's elite to be able to use this capacity to promote the country's scientific and technological capabilities.
Following scientific advancement as well as decades of protest, Iran seems to be also winning political victories against U.S. suppression.
Due to restoration of sanctions by the U.S. and based on the 1955 Treaty of Amity signed by the U.S. and Iran, Tehran filed a protest to the International Court of Justice, which voted in favor of Iran.
After the Islamic Revolution, we had the feeling that we can work on scientific issues inside the country and have something to say, and be able to have a proportioned exchange in the international interactions. Our researchers and many of our educated youth had this feeling. Before the Islamic Revolution, these people did not have the self-esteem and courage to enter complicated scientific fields.
Our focus having been science today, I must say, science is nothing new to this country and the world of Islam. We may have had a bad 20th century, but this country has risen from the ashes. It is, however, still dusting itself, but it has come a long way, and together with other Muslim countries, it intends to revive the golden age of the world of Islam, the age of Avicenna and Khwarazmi. To encourage a revival, the Mustafa Awards were introduced, and Iran will be presenting the biennial award to laureates in October. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do remember to return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, and to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Iranians across the country are celebrating the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, which toppled the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime back in the year 1979. This is an occasion that is marked not only in Iran, but around the world. Why this revolution has captured the psyche of many around the world and how it has withstood the offensive onslaught by some Western countries, especially the U.S., and, of course, the achievements, will be discussed in this edition of The Debate.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in a different way this year. More than 6,000 Iranian and some 200 foreign journalists, photographers, and cameramen have covered the event. Nationwide rallies were staged by processions of cars, motorcycles, and bicycles in the capital city of Tehran and other cities across the country. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus outbreak to express their support for ideals of the Islamic Revolution. In Tehran, thousands of cars, motorcycles, and bicycles converged at Azadi Square, the site of major national rallies over the past four decades. Ballistic missiles of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, namely Zulfaqar Basir, Qiyam, and Desful, were also put on display as part of the ceremonies at Azadi Square.
I have participated in this special form of rally this year to show my support for the Islamic Revolution and sit down with the U.S., down with Israel.
I am very happy to be here because this is a test for our loyalty to the Islamic Revolution. I know I have passed this test because I'm here to voice my support for my leader.
We are here to support our revolution. We take to streets every year, and even coronavirus has not stopped us from celebrating this occasion.
Speaking on the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has hailed the progress the country has made following the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
The late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, relied on people to make the revolution successful. That asset is now threatened by the enemy who seeks to divide the Iranian nation. Such threats can be countered through resistance and unity, and that's what the Iranian people currently have. The country has been under intense pressure in the past several years due to the U.S. economic war, but now everyone admits that the U.S. pressure campaign has failed.
In addition to the annual theme of renewing support for the revolution and Islamic establishment, this year rallies are important since former U.S. President Donald Trump, who vowed he would bring the Iranian nation to its knees, is gone, and the Iranian people are standing stronger than ever before.
This year, ralliers have shouted their protest at the U.S. and its allies for their sanctions against Iran, voicing pleasure at Donald Trump, former U.S. president's failure in his maximum pressure policy against the country. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Saeed Mohammad Marandi, who's a university professor and political analyst, joining us. Professor Marandi, welcome. Obviously, congratulations are in place for this very special day, the 42nd year of the Islamic revolutions that has occurred. And I'm going to try to test your memory in this case and ask you how you have viewed this and how you've experienced this year after year, and then, of course, as the decades rolled by, and how it has transformed itself in your views, things that stand out for you.
Well, I recall as a child when I would ask family acquaintances and relatives what Iran actually produced, they would usually ridicule Iran and make statements that were reflective of the fact that Iran really didn't have its own indigenous research and development or an indigenous industry. And as you know quite well, when the forces of Saddam Hussein, with the help of Europe and both Eastern and Western blocs, invaded Iran, Iran was more or less defenseless, even though Iran was sort of like Saudi Arabia, constantly purchasing American weapons. But since Iran didn't make its own spare parts and it didn't develop any of its own weaponry, those weapons were soon proven to be almost useless, until gradually the Iranians learned how to make spare parts. They gradually learned how to make their own equipment, both military and non-military, and things began to change in the country. But also, I think a second difference is something that I, again, my personal experience. The first time I volunteered to go to the war, I was 16, and I went to the Kurdish Iranian city of Bukhan, where the Saddam Hussein's forces were supporting terrorist organizations there, and I was based there. At that time, Bukhan only had one physician, and he was not Iranian. Much of the city didn't have electricity. Much of the city didn't have running water. Many people, their children didn't go to school, especially in the towns. And there were areas in the city where there was no electricity whatsoever. Now, there's no part of the country where you do not have physicians, hospitals, electricity, telephone, gas, natural gas. I think almost 99% of all houses in Iranian cities have natural gas. So the changes that were brought about in small cities, in impoverished areas of major cities, and in towns and villages are extraordinary. Young people don't recall those days, but because of my experience in the war, I have my own personal experiences in the provinces and in poorer areas. And these areas that I visited after the war came to an end and in recent years, they are just incomparable to what they were 4 decades ago. And that is despite sanctions, and that's despite war, and despite the animosity that Iran continues to face.
Well, let me introduce our next guest here, Mutaz Al-Wahwa, who is an activist and political commentator who joins us from Beirut. Mutaz Al-Wahwa, welcome. Our guest there, Professor Mohammad Marandi, was talking about the achievements, for the most part there, of Iran since the Islamic Revolution occurred back some 42 years ago. Now, maybe you can put it into perspective, because when you break that down, even though 42 years might sound like a lot, it really isn't, because you have that 8-year war, you have the period after the revolution where things have to settle down. When you take into consideration the way that the country has been pressured, even though a lot of achievements have occurred, this is still a very young revolution in a matter of speaking. What are your impressions of the revolution overall, especially in terms of the length of time that it has occurred?
First of all, good evening, and again, an honor to be on here and an honor to be on with Dr. Morandi. Yeah, you're right. 42 years is really nothing when it comes to world history, and especially modern history and the age of nations. And like you mentioned, 42 years, and the Islamic Republic has not had one day of rest. So we had the 8-year war, and then after the war, the sanctions, the Black Ops War, if you want to call it, the war of the secret services. So the Islamic Republic still hasn't really had a day's rest from the day of the start of the revolution 42 years ago, from when the revolution was successful 42 years ago. Politically speaking, I think the mere fact that this revolution has maintained its momentum and survived for the last 42 years is nothing short of a miracle, absolutely nothing short of a miracle, especially if we look at the developments that the doctor was pointing out, developments and the advancements on all fields. Iran today is a giant when it comes to medicine, when it comes to technology, when it comes to culture, when it comes to philosophy. Iran in the region and in the world is today a giant. More than that, the Islamic Republic today, and I'm going to talk about on a regional scale, the Islamic Republic today has managed to gain the respect of friend and foe in the region and outside of the region. So this revolution, which has been targeted from day one, this revolution which has been fought on all fronts from day one, has managed to emerge from the ashes and managed to present to us an Iran which is 1,000 times stronger than Iran before the revolution.
Dr. Morandi,
and this is not just on a national or on a local scale, but not this. I'm talking on a regional scale and on an international scale.
Dr. Morandi, one of the things that gets mentioned about Iran when people have traveled across other countries is that it gets hailed for standing up to the hegemonic powers, such as the U.S., for example. In that respect, what reason does the U.S. have to have such a strong animosity towards a country like Iran when, if you take a look at the transition from what it was, which was a dictatorship, to an independent country that has democratic institutions in place, voting takes place, there's a parliament that decides on the laws, and yet the U.S. backs dictators, especially in this region?
Well, I think it's very clear that the issue that the United States has with Iran has nothing to do with human rights or democracy or terrorism, but it is the very fact that Iran is a strong, independent country. Iran broke away from the Western bloc and pursued an independent policy after the revolution. And the United States has never really forgiven Iran for that. And it really begins with the revolution itself. The problem was the revolution. The Iranians are not like the Turkish government, where when the Americans put a bit of pressure on President Erdogan, he shuts down the S-400s or he wants to improve relations with Israel. And of course, compared to Egypt, Turkey is has a much stronger independent foreign policy. Countries like Egypt or Saudi Arabia really have no independence whatsoever. So while a lot does go back to the fact that Iran has become a stronger country, a much stronger country, that is because of its independence. As I said earlier, Iran has a national healthcare network that is non-existent in this part of the world, and it's one of the best in the world. This was all developed after the revolution because one of the key slogans of the revolution was social justice. And I would argue that recent administrations, whether the Rouhani or the Ahmadinejad or the Khatami administrations, and even the Rafsanjani administrations, I think have not done enough in this regard, and that we've sort of moved away from those ideals of social justice that were very strong in the first decade of the revolution. I think liberalism has moved us away from some of those ideals, and we should return to them. But still, Iran's independence and its ability to take care of the poor and disenfranchised segments of society, of course, not necessarily, the situation is not ideal. But still, Iran's inherent strength, its independence comes, it's a sort of two-way street. Iran's independence allows it to become strong as a nation, and also its internal strength, the fact that it does have democratic institutions, no matter what Western governments say, the fact that Iran has a strong sense of independence and pride in their independence, that too makes it a stronger country. So this is something that's not tolerable and or acceptable to the United States or the Europeans. They would definitely like to see Iran like Saudi Arabia, like the Emirates, like Egypt, and like, to a degree, Turkey.
Well, it was very interesting that during a previous interview, Mutaz al-Awawa, we had a guest that said that if it wasn't for the Islamic Revolution, and if it wasn't for Iran after the Islamic Revolution, that there would be no Lebanon. And the association that I'd like to ask you to make there, is it because of the fact that the Iran after the Islamic Revolution was a country that stood for the oppressed, and Palestinians were part of that, and out of that, perhaps there were resistance groups that came into the picture, and of course, we could talk about how Iran has supported, for example, Hezbollah in the way that it has protected Lebanon in that respect. So is that one of the things that has happened after the Islamic Revolution, the way that Iran stood up for the oppressed? And then, of course, we could talk about Hezbollah and how it has protected Lebanon from the offensive coming from Israel, for example.
Well, if we look at the role Iran played before the revolution, let's say in the in regards to the Arab or the Arab Zionist conflict, or specifically the Lebanese civil war here, it's no secret that the deposed monarchy in Iran was an ally of the Zionist regime. It was very, very cozy with this regime during the Lebanese civil war here. There were phalangist movements, anti-resistance movements that received funding from the Shah of Iran. It was clear that they were on the side of the imperialists, they were on the side of the US, they were on the side of the Israelis, and they were very cozy because the Shah of Iran, being the US puppet that he was, found that he could that it was his duty in order to show allegiance or loyalty to his masters. After the Islamic Revolution, there was a 180-degree turn, and we've seen the role of the Islamic Republic, not just here in the region, not just in supporting the Palestinian cause or supporting the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, or even in Iraq or in Syria or in Yemen, but going further than that. So we hear and we have documented documented facts regarding the Islamic Republic's assistance to the Muslims of Bosnia. So when the Muslims of Bosnia were being slaughtered and massacred by Serbs, and these were Sunni Muslims, sorry to use such term, but these were Sunni Muslims being massacred by right-wing Serbian militias, and the entire world was silent, except for the Islamic Republic of Iran, who not only sent logistical support and financial support, but sent brave young men who until today are buried in the soils of Bosnia. When it comes to the issue of Kashmir, the Islamic Republic has been a champion. When it comes to the issues of all the oppressed all over the world, and I think Imam Khomeini made it very clear in that revolutionary gesture when he released the African-American prisoners that were being held at the former U.S. embassy, because he viewed them as an oppressed people. So yes, the Islamic Republic today, not just in the region but all over the world, is a symbol. Is a symbol of justice. It has stood by the oppressed against the oppressor, and stood by with words, but actively stood by, fighting against the oppressors. Yes, definitely. If it was not the Islamic Republic of Iran, there would not be a serious force in the region resisting Israeli occupation, resisting U.S. Ambitions in the region. And the greatest threat to the United States' foreign policy today is the Islamic Republic of Iran. they really don't care if the Islamic Republic was to, let's say, adopt Islamic law in Iran. That's not their problem. Their problem is not that Iran chose to become an Islamic Republic and practice Sharia to some extent. Their problem is that Iran chose to practice it to the fullest extent. They did not want an Islamic Republic that would say no to the US. They did not want an Islamic Republic that would empower the nations, that would wake them up from being slaves, that would wake them up from being robbed of their resources and robbed of their rights and their freedoms.
Okay. Dr. Morandi, back in the year 2010, 2011, roughly, there was what was called the so-called Arab Spring, in which we refer to it as the Islamic Awakening. And when that happened, and a little bit afterwards, there was a lot of comparisons that were being made by the people to the Islamic Revolution. It started in Tunisia, and then it obviously was spreading. Why was that comparison being made? What happened there that stood and that had rung a tone with the people who initiated that?
Well, before I respond, let me just add on to what your good guest has said. And that is, before the revolution, one of the differences was that the Shah had very good relations with the apartheid regime in South Africa. The Shah supported the United States in its war in Vietnam. So the Iranian regime was not only oppressing its own people, but was also helping Western regimes and their allies oppress other nations. Whereas after the revolution, Iran immediately broke off ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa, of course the apartheid regime in Palestine as well. Iran began supporting resistance movements both in South Africa and Palestine, and of course ended cooperation with the United States, the imperial agenda. But with regards to the Arab Spring, the South, yeah, that while there were like similarities, that these were popular movements and they were based on indigenous values, but the leaders of these movements began to both cooperate with the Saudis, with the Israelis, and with the Americans. And these are the very same massive, aggressive imperial forces which always hold these nations back. So leadership of Egypt basically allowed the Americans, the Israelis, and the Saudis to undermine their country.
All right, thank you for that. Unfortunately, we were having some audio problems there with you. We do apologize. But that brings us to the end of this debate. I want to thank Professor Sayed Mohammed Morandi there, university professor and political analyst. I'd also like to thank Motaz Al Wehwa, who's an activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thanks for joining us for another edition of the debate. From Ikovet Havai, entire team here in the capital.